Senate's most important and powerful committees.
It's good to be here. It's much like Washington and Lee holding a mock Democratic convention. It's much like Harvard holding a mock Republican convention. I would appreciate if for the next few minutes you would take the advice of your chairman and act like Democrats, be enlightened. Now, I met an enlightened man on the way in. Every once in a while, ladies and gentlemen, when you show up at a function to speak, you're not quite sure what to expect, but you begin to get an inkling as you approach the podium. And I got a clear message when a student was selling and people were buying for $1 apiece the following bumper sticker. Nixon, now more than ever. I tell you, it's good to be here in the 19th century. What I'd like to do most of all, though, is compliment you all on your very good judgment in inviting me to speak. I am one of the most important men in America. I am certain not a one of you wondered who in the hell is Joe Biden. You all immediately knew I was that dynamic young senator from the great state of Delaware, and it is a state who, in fact, would be president this very moment, but for the fact I wasn't old enough last time. But for the few of you who don't know just how heavy I am, let me tell you a true story so you have a framework within which to place the remarks that I will make tonight. And unfortunately, this is true, which doesn't often happen at a convention, particularly a Democratic convention. And that is, not very long ago, there was a good deal of publicity in the Northeast, that is part of America, in the Northeast. There was a good deal of national coverage. There is a good deal of national coverage about who could have sought the Democratic nomination, and unfortunately a fellow named Patrick Cadell and several others went out and did a poll in Iowa and New Hampshire, and the poll demonstrated that a young senator from Delaware could win the nomination if he ran. Wait a minute. And several came and asked and talked about it, but the senator from Delaware decided not to do it. But nonetheless, there was a lot of publicity that flowed from that and talk about the future aspirations of the senator from Delaware. And I hadn't thought much about being president, but I figured if Jerry Brown could be president, I know I could. And so I sort of launched my one-person campaign for the presidency in my little state. Now, my state is very small, very important, but small. And I tell you what, it has the best-looking women in any delegation out there. I tell you that, too. I don't mean those three guys that stood up. And unfortunately, it's a true story. And what happened was, my state being as small as it is, I had already represented it for 11 years, and I had not, in this same time this was going on in the press, It had taken 11 years, it's absolutely true, 11 years for me to get invited to speak at the single most important political function in the state of Delaware, and that is the statewide agricultural convention. Now, if I were from Virginia and you're interested in politics, I wouldn't laugh. It's pretty important to y'all, too. And I had several liabilities. If you know anything, if you read the book Chesapeake, you understand my state. My state thinks it's part of the South. My state, in fact, they talk funny like y'all do down here, you know what I mean, in the southern part of my state. And I had several liabilities when I first ran for the Senate at age 29. I was young, I was Irish, I was Catholic, and I was from upstate. Now, wait a minute. Much like on this convention floor, I suspect, they were liabilities. I could have only thing that could have made me worse off in the southern part of my state had I been an Irish, Catholic, black, liberal, Jewish convert. But, so it took 11 years. It's a true story. It took 11 years for me to get invited to speak to this function. And I immediately accepted. I wanted to demonstrate to them I didn't have horns and breathe fire. And I was heading on what we call down home. And those who know Delaware, there's a couple Delawareans here, know that southern Delaware is referred to as down home. I headed on down home looking for the Gumboro Fire Hall where this speech was. And this very important United States senator pulled into a gas station on Route 13. You'd call it a turnpike or a four-lane divided highway. In the southern part of my state, they call it the Dual. And I pulled off the Dual into this gas station. That's absolutely true. Let's know just how important I am. I pulled in with a state that I represented 11 years, 600,000 people, all this national publicity. I pulled into the gas station. I said, can you tell me how to get to the Gumboro Fire Hall? And this good old boy, it was raining like the devil. This good old boy came out in a rain hat and a slicker, the whole works. And when I rolled out my window to ask the question, it was raining so hard I had to lean back from the steering wheel to get keep from getting wet. And it's absolutely true. And he looked in the window at me and he said, can I help you, boy? And I figured he just didn't see me. And I said, yes, you can. I said, you can tell me how to get to the Gumboro Fire Hall. It's absolutely true. And he said, hot damn, what's going on up to Gumboro tonight? He said, you're the fourth boy to ask me how to get to Fire Hall. And I said, there's an agricultural dinner up there. This is true. He said, who's speaking to the dinner? And I said, Joe Biden. And he got a big grin on his face. I thought he recognized me, and I leaned into the rain. He said, Joe boy? I said, yes, sir. He said, hot damn. You tell Joe boy I said hello, will you? He and I are just like that. True story. So as you can see, you are indeed fortunate to have a man of my renown here tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, I suspect there may be at some point in this speech, which I'm going to try to be serious, what you might refer to as a lack of communication, I suspect. And I don't ask you to tolerate me. I don't ask you to agree to me. I don't even ask you to listen to me. I just ask you to think about it. Think about listening. You know, there's a very good friend of mine, a Republican senator from Wyoming named Alan Simpson. He said, no, Joe. He's a hell of a guy, by the way. And he said, you know, Joe, Mr. Chairman, probably you heard this story. He said, you know, Joe, he said, when I talk about lack of communication, it reminds me of a story of a couple I know in Wyoming. They live out in the prairie and they go to bed early. And he said, one night after they got in bed, his husband and wife got in bed, going to sleep, 9:30, 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, the phone rang. He said, the husband groped for the phone and found it and picked it up. And he said, hello? No. How the hell should I know? That's 2,000 miles from here. And he hung the phone up. And the wife tugged at him and said, what was that, honey? He said, I don't know, just some damn fool asking if the coast was clear. You're not that stupid, are you? Come on, that's loud, you know. Well, I suspect, just as you didn't understand my joke, you may not understand my speech. But your job, my job is to talk. Yours is to listen. Y'all finish yours before I finish mine. Raise your hand, and I'll get the hell out of here. We got a couple there. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to be serious with you for a few moments, if I may. I come tonight not to seek your approval, but to tell you what's on my mind. And some of it you may not like, but I sincerely hope you give me my day in court and give me a shot at it. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, not because of any one person and not because of any one party, but nonetheless, I believe America's in trouble. And I believe my party's in trouble. And as every hour passes, our ability to shape America's future is literally slipping from our grasp. And you and I in this room, and me and my party, share the blame for how we got to this point, and more importantly, share the responsibility for moving us beyond this point. My blame lies in not doing enough to stop the failing policies of this and the last administration, and failing to reinvigorate my party with the fervor it once had. When I was 17 years old, I participated in sit-ins to desegregate restaurants and movie houses, and my stomach turned upon hearing the voices of Faubus and Wallace, and my soul raged upon seeing the dogs of Bull Connor. When I was 18 years old, my spirit soared when a young president stood on the steps of the Capitol and said, "As corny as it sounds today, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country." And when I was 25 years of age, when I was 25 years old, I stood beside a railroad track in Wilmington, Delaware, with my sister Valerie, and openly wept with thousands of other Delawareans as the funeral train of a great American slowly passed by. But at age 40, and as a Democratic leader of the Judiciary Committee, I had to be reminded, as a Democrat who got involved in politics because he cared about the injustice in the world, in this country, I had to be reminded that Mississippi still has a dual registration system. I became involved in politics because of civil rights, and now I'm a force in American politics in spite of mounting civil wrongs. At age 40, my attention has been diverted and my vision has been blurred as a consequence of being overwhelmed by special interest and special interest pleadings. But I'm not the only one in my party or the other party whose attention has been distracted and whose vision has been blurred. You and our party also went astray by failing to remember what got us as far as we got and how we got here. It was moral indignation, decent instincts, a sense of shared sacrifice and mutual responsibility, and a set of national priorities that emphasized what we had in common, not what divided us. A party whose vision produced the greatest economic prosperity and the broadest commitment to social justice the world has ever seen became complacent and unwilling to adjust its programs to accommodate a changing world. The party that was the engine of the national interest, molding the pluralistic interest into a compelling new social contract that served this nation well for 50 years, became a party that was little more than a broker for narrow special interest. Instead of thinking of ourselves as Americans first, Democrats second, and members of an interest group third, we began to think in terms of special interest first and the greater interest second. And one other thing. And one other thing, my party let its opponents set the agenda and define what was at stake for America. Suddenly, the party that had been the party of ideas, change and experimentation, became perceived in 1980 as the party of the status quo. Our unwillingness to adapt our programs and change them where they were wrong and some were wrong allowed our opponents to assault our entire agenda. Food stamps for well-to-do college students became the issue rather than feeding hungry Americans. Busing became the issue rather than advancing equal educational opportunity. And consensus on education, jobs, public assistance, and health began to vanish. And the fervor for the pursuit of civil rights, arms control, and tax equity, they all began to fade. And the wedge had been driven. The democratic movement began to stall. And for the first time in 50 years, the Democratic Party lost the initiative. And as a consequence, there's a president in the White House who is a good man, but he is committed to abrogating that social contract that fundamentally worked so well for so long. There is a president in the White House as a consequence of the Democratic Party not remembering who it is, who in fact tends to appeal to the anxieties and fears of the American people and not to their courage and their sense of fair play. And there's not the slightest hope of resuming progress toward justice and equality as long as the present policies remain intact. Nearly 20 years ago, a courageous man said, "Now is the time to lift our national policy from the quicksand of injustice to the solid rock of human dignity." But two decades later, we find ourselves caught no better than midway between the quicksand and the rock, and led by political leadership in both parties that cannot distinguish one from the other. Ladies and gentlemen, what most troubles me about the present political leaders of the world and of our nation, including their opponents, is that none of them are speaking out with any eloquence about the coming age, but are concentrating mainly on the present day or the next election. President Reagan says very little, if anything. President Reagan says very little, if anything, practical about the computerized world of the future, or how to rescue the old smokestack workers of Pittsburgh, Youngstown, or Detroit, or to educate a rising generation in new skills that they and the nation will need between now and the end of the century. And unless I miss my guess, the American people are sick of all the contention between both political parties, the regions, and the races, the unions and the management, and would listen to any candidate in any party willing to concentrate on unity, peace, and education for our children. And the defense of our civilization was something in addition to smart bombs and laser beams in outer space. The main question is not whether or not Ronald Reagan will be elected, but whether or not he'll think about the future. The issue before this country and the allegiance of this country is much wider and deeper than anything that has been discussed in politics of this country or the world thus far in this election. Ladies and gentlemen, I will not exaggerate with you. I will not lie to you and tell you I am absolutely confident that whomever the Democratic nominee is, that they will, in fact, have the answer. But let me just ask you a question, and I'm being totally sincere in this entire speech. Let me ask you a question. Is, in fact, there enough being said? Is there, in fact, enough being discussed in this nation about the 21st century? Are we, in fact, as a nation, sincerely addressing the problems we all know will face you and your children? And the answer is, my party has not been doing a very good job of it, but I do not believe we have been getting very much in the way of the future for the past 4 years. Ladies and gentlemen, I am a Democrat, and I want my party to win. But the only way my party can win or has a right to win is if we avoid imitating the past, only if we stop fighting Ronald Reagan at the margins of his policy and challenge the fundamental and false assumptions of his philosophy. Only if my party once again asserts the primacy of the national interest over the demands of special interest. And only if we offer a national vision that reflects the enduring principles of our party and the tradition of innovation that has been its hallmark. But most of all, only if we as a party stand openly and unbendingly on those moral issues that are at the core of our nation's soul, only if we defend these beliefs and risk the consequences, only if we're willing to risk defeat for what we believe, can we ever hope to win the support of the American people for what we propose. I believe there are moral issues on which we must take a stand as a nation because they define the character of our nation. They are the values that answer for us what kind of people are we. It's long past time for this nation and for my party, the party that was willing to break itself apart over the moral issue of civil rights in the 60s, to end its silence in the 80s. How can the party, my party, that went to war with itself over the war in Southeast Asia, fail to stop a failing policy in Central America? How can the party that began the arms control process that was carried forward by Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford, how can that party be unwilling to challenge an administration that refuses even to report out of the Foreign Relations Committee a nuclear test ban treaty? How can a party lose to a president who can overcome his inhibitions about feeding hungry Russians, but not feed hungry Americans? And how can my party fail to provide an alternative for the millions of industrial workers who are being thrown on the industrial scrap heap because they were born too soon for the technological revolution? Ladies and gentlemen, I think it's time not only my party but all of America draw a line in the dust accumulating around our past achievements and declare we have had enough, we will yield no more. but there are those voices in American politics, in both political parties, who, when I say the things I say tonight, tell me that we should be cautious because they say the American people are tired. Well, to those voices I say, you don't understand the American people. Will we heed the voices in this nation who say, which I suspect some of you have even said, much progress has been made. Now we must wait for the Reagan Revolution to subside. To those voices I say, we cannot wait or our very soul will be corrupted by our silence. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe the American people are preparing to respond to a political leadership from either political party that is prepared to tell the farmers of Iowa that feeding hungry Americans is less important than feeding hungry Americans. I believe that this country is prepared to respond to a leadership that'd be willing to go to southern Delaware and Virginia and Alabama and declare that civil rights is the moral test of the American dream. Who will go to women's groups and tell them that restoration of a compassionate government and a sane nuclear policy is just as important as freedom of choice and ERA. A leadership that will go to the teachers' unions and say that competency is as important to the revitalization of American education as higher pay and smaller classes. We'll go to business groups and tell them that their preoccupation with short-term profits at the expense of long-term investment is more damaging to our economic future than government spending on social programs. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for a new dawn to break over America. It's time to restore this nation's soul. It's time to get about this nation's moral business again. But this will require a leadership that will go to the American people, telling us what it proposes, not what it promises. Telling us what it demands of us as a people, not merely what it plans on doing. Students, let me ask you a question. What, in fact, has this country come to? Whether you're a Democrat or Republican or independent, and I'm deadly serious when I ask this question. What have we come to as a nation when in 24 years we have moved from the standard of ask not what your country can do for you to the standard that says, are you better off today than you were yesterday? Whether you are a Democrat or a Republican, I mean with every fiber of my being, I hope to God the standard that you set for America to repair to is not the selfish standard of am I better off? Is America better off? Is the question. Ladies and gentlemen, I am 41 years old, and like many people in the bleachers, They share with me the distinction of being part of the post-war generation that is the largest generation in the history of this country, a generation that entered the political process in response to a courageous president who set a high standard, in response to an eloquent black man who shared his dream for racial equality on a steamy August day with all of us. And many in my generation, to my generation and to yours, has now come a challenge. In the days that will come, we will be tested on whether or not we have the moral courage, the realism, the idealism, and the tenacity to sacrifice some of our current creature comforts to invest in the future. But the cynics among us believe that my generation and yours, in your case about to reach, in my case having reached, the conservative age of mortgage payments, pediatricians' bills, and concerns about our children's welfare, are ripe for conservative picking. These experts believe that, like the Democratic Party itself, the less than 40-year-old voter is prepared to sell his soul for some security, whether it's real or illusory. But I believe, and I mean this, I believe they've misjudged us. Just because our political heroes were murdered does not mean that the dream does not still live buried in our broken hearts. I believe that this generation will rise to the challenge, for these are the same people who gave 2 years of their lives helping starving families in the jungles of Africa, or teaching illiterates in the mountains of Appalachia, or 55,000 of them dying in Vietnam for a cause they thought and were told was their obligation. These same people, they'll march to the beat of the right drummer. Ladies and gentlemen, my party has an obligation to mend the broken hearts of my generation. With the same tonic that fired its political activism 2 decades ago, and end the political apathy and alienation that have characterized it for too long. A 40-year-old man spoke to my generation specifically when he said, and I quote, "Our answer is the world's hope. It is to rely upon youth. The cruelties and obstacles of this swiftly changing planet will not yield to the obsolete dogmas and outworn slogans. It cannot be moved by those who cling to a present which is already dying, who prefer the illusion of security to the excitement and danger which comes with even the most peaceful of progress. The world demands the quality of youth, not a time of life, but a state of mind, a temper of the will, a quality of the imagination, a preponderance of courage over timidity, of the appetite of adventure over the love of ease. Years of darkness and torrents of disappointment separate that day from this hour when Robert Kennedy spoke to my generation. But I believe, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, his words still echo down through this hall, reminding us that only with our idealism and our commitment and our energy can we ever hope to achieve the destiny that history has laid out for this great nation. And it will not be done as blacks or as whites, as workers or as professionals, as rich or as poor, as women or as men. It won't even be done as Democrats or as Republicans, but only as a people of God in the service of the American dream. Thank you very much.
The chair will now call a 5-minute recess. Will the delegates please remain in the general seating area as we will begin promptly again in 5 minutes.